Session number 3178, reel number 1.
So Geoffrey Tuttle, Reel 1. Can I begin by asking you just to say a bit about your family background, where you were born and what sort of family you came from?
I was born in Lowestoft, the most easterly point in England, in 1906. I remember very little about it except that I was 8 when World War I started and my father went away to the war. My mother was left with 3 boys, and because the town was being shelled by German battleships, we evacuated no less than 10 miles to the town of Bungay. And we remained away, either there or in other parts of Suffolk, for most of the war. About all I remember is my father coming back from the war, actually from Salonika. We were a large family with a family business in the town, and the 3 boys all went to St. Paul's School. I didn't like school and asked if I could leave early, and my father said yes, certainly, and I went to be an apprentice at Ransomes and Rapier in Ipswich at my own request. I did not like engineering, and within 2 years I had decided the only thing I wanted to do was to fly. So I joined the Royal Air Force with a short service commission.
Let me stop you there and just ask you, had you heard anything very much about the Royal Air Force before, or come into contact with Royal Air Force people, or indeed been up in a plane at all before you took this decision in 1925 to join the RAF? What were the kind of factors that propelled you towards it?
I think there are these. First of all, I had done a 5-bob flight in what I now know to be an Avro 504, and I had been to see 2 aeroplanes during the war when they landed in a field, and I had seen a Zeppelin shot down. The final incentive was an advertisement which said, join the RAF and fly for free. And that decided that, as that was the only way I was ever going to fly, I joined the Royal Air Force.
Had you intended initially to take a short service commission?
Originally, I intended to join the Volunteer Reserve, but inadvertently I got a short service commission and, of course, was delighted when I found I'd made the mistake.
Where did you actually have to go to sign on?
I went to Duxford. One of the experiments by Lord Trenchard was not only the short service commission, but in order to increase the intake, a certain number of pilots were sent direct to fighter or bomber squadrons, which formed a training flight. And my first appearance in uniform was as a pilot officer on probation in 19 Fighter Squadron at Duxford in September 1925.
Tell me, what was the reaction of your family and the friends of your family to the news that you decided to go into the Royal Air Force?
I remember very clearly that my mother was depressed because she thought I'd get killed. Her friends were upset because it was not respectable to belong to the Royal Air Force. And indeed, my car insurance was restricted, as it was for actors, Jews, and members of the Royal Air Force.
Had you yourself heard about this rather dubious reputation of the RAF before you actually joined up?
I know I hadn't heard about it because I'd not just come in contact with it.
When you actually joined up, what were the causes, or before you joined up, what were the causes of this bad reputation, do you think? And what kind of things did you find went on when you actually joined a squadron for the first time that may have justified this reputation?
The main cause of it not being regarded as respectable was that it wasn't the Navy and it wasn't the Army. The sons of the gentry normally went into one of those if they couldn't earn a living somehow else. The other reason was that the reputation of hard living was undoubtedly true. And at that time, the accident rate was a headliner, although by modern standards, no higher than usual.
Let's look at those two elements then. First of all, the hard living. What sort of things went on that particularly deserved that reputation?
At that age, when I was 18 or 19, the flight commanders, most of them, had been in the war and had not, other than in battle, done terribly well because they were flight lieutenants of some seniority. And they drank a considerable amount. For example, we all went over to the mess in the morning for pink gins. I myself was a teetotaler. And I did not regard that as abnormal. Naturally, other people did. I suppose, because of the insurance problem, the accident rate was higher. But in general, it was regarded as not a respectable occupation.
Did people attempt to drink and fly?
They didn't attempt, they did.
Did any accidents result from that?
I am quite certain that one of my best friends was killed when he had had too much to drink. Naturally, I was not at the Court of Inquiry, and I wasn't actually on the station during the accident, but I know what happened, and one or two may have been caused by that.
What actually happened to your friend?
He dived into the ground, for apparently no reason.
Was this an after-lunch flight?
It was after lunch, yes.
As a teetotaler yourself, were you at any time made to feel slightly out of it as a result of this? Was any pressure ever put on you to join the crowd in the bar?
I would hate to appear a saint in answering that question. I didn't drink because I didn't like drink. But undoubtedly people did try to make people who did not drink drink when they didn't want to, and naturally therefore I refused. And as a result, I probably remained a teetotaler longer than I might have done.
But you weren't sort of shunned as a result at all?
I certainly wasn't shunned, and I was regarded as quite a useful chauffeur.
With regard to other forms of what you might call misbehaviour, you were telling me last time about the things when you went on when you actually became adjutant in your first fighter squadron.
Mentioned the number of the squadron, I had better be careful because I would hate to do anybody any damage. But one of the things I was taught was how to forge signatures, as I would be more useful that way. That rather surprised me, and as far as I know, I didn't ever have to do it.
What about the use, private use of fuels?
Well, one interesting thing was that on Friday afternoons, those of us who had cars were led, taken by the squadron commander to the fuel buzzers to fill up our cars. I did not know at that time that it wasn't even legal, but it was regarded as a perfectly normal procedure.
When you actually joined the RAF, did you think in terms of a long-term career right at the beginning? Did you think in terms of security at all when you first joined?
No thought of security ever occurred, I believe, at that time to anybody of my age. I joined because I wanted to fly. I did not ask what the pay was or what the pension scheme was, but I knew I wanted to make it a life career. The only way of starting it was a short service commission.
Where did you, initially, I think you had to report to Uxbridge in the first instance.
Yes, all these pilot officers on probation had to report to Uxbridge, where they were interviewed, and I remember the first interview where there were about six of us who had never been in the Air Force. We were interviewed by a very old man. He was a flight lieutenant with war medals, and therefore to us was unbelievably old. The war had been over 7 years. His opening remark was, to all of us, "You have joined the Royal Air Force to be killed. You will either be killed by your own stupidity, or if you last long enough, by the enemy if there's a war. If you don't want to be killed, you'd better leave the room now." None of us, of course, had the guts to leave the room.
What actually happened at Uxbridge? What was the purpose of going there initially?
As far as I know, it was to look at you and have a medical examination. There didn't appear to be any academic examination, as far as I can remember, but that is 53 years ago.
How long were you actually at Uxbridge before you went to Uxbridge?
4 days.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Which was up there for an interview.
Were you given any other preliminary training, or were you then immediately sent on to...
We went straight to Uxbridge from home, having had one interview at Uxbridge, including the medical examination.
So, in September 1925, you joined 19 Fighter Squadron at Uxbridge. Let's deal first of all with the actual basics of learning to fly. What planes did you learn on, and how was the training conducted?
There were three fighter squadrons at Uxbridge. I was in 19 Squadron, and each squadron formed a training flight with Avro 504K aircraft with rotary engines. Each squadron had three pilot officers like me, and the training flight had a flight commander who was an instructor, and as far as I can remember, two other instructors, one of whom was a sergeant pilot. We had a training syllabus of flying and a ground training syllabus where we were taught by officers in one of the squadrons in either very limited navigation, administration, law, and subjects like that. We got our wings very much sooner than anybody who was going through the organized syllabus of a flying training school. And our lectures were remarkably short, but adequate, I think, by the subsequent career we followed.
Did you yourself have any problems learning to fly?
I had a tremendous problem landing, and eventually my squadron commander said he would try to teach me to land, and I was so afraid of him I learnt to land. By the simple word or lesson, keep it off the ground as long as you can. And that is not a bad tip for landing that type of aircraft. It's rather different now.
Did you have a good squadron commander?
I had a tremendous squadron commander who is unfortunately now dead and was killed during the war. But he was, again to us, a very, very, very old man. He was 33. But he always won the air firing competition. He was by far the best pilot in the squadron, which was not usual in most post-war squadrons, pre-war squadrons.
How soon were you actually tested for your wings?
I was tested for my wings well within the year, and I think it was in about 6 months, but I haven't got my logbook here.
Can you tell me what happened when you went to be tested for your wings at Uphaven?
As we went going through the normal procedure of a flying training school, we had to go to the Central Flying School, then at Uphaven, to be tested for our wings. And I flew down there from Uxbridge to be tested by Flying Officer Atchley, who was already famous as one of the best pilots in the Royal Air Force. I was asked by Dick Atchley to get in the front seat of the Avro he was testing me in. Incidentally, I had never been in the front seat before. And it was parked parallel to the hangars on a grass airfield. He got in the back and said through the tube intercommunication system that he would start up and take off. I therefore was to do nothing till we were airborne. He started up, and while that was going on, I noticed another aeroplane, a woodcock, a different type of fighter, taxi in and park in front of us. I was surprised when he waved the chocks away and opened the throttle, because I did not see how he was going to miss the aeroplane that had parked itself in front. As I was at the Central Flying School and being tested by the most famous pilot in the Royal Air Force, I assumed he was going to do something that I had never seen done before and miss it. He had not seen it, and suddenly there was a tremendous bang, and we removed all our starboard wings and all its port wings and ended up in a smoking heap. We got out of that, and he said, get in another one, and tested me for my wings. Not surprisingly, I passed.
You mentioned just now that you regarded the RAF officers who'd served in the First World War as rather elderly gentlemen. Do you think that they were a good or perhaps a bad influence on the squadron as a whole, or on you personally?
I'm quite certain that they were a good influence on the Royal Air Force and on the eventual product, because they showed what could be done with aeroplanes and with life. I think on our own, we would have missed their leadership tremendously.
Was there any competition within the squadron between officers with short service commissions like yourself and those with permanent commissions, the Cranwell people?
At that stage, there was no competition at all. We, of course, at that stage, we were pupils, and the Cranwellians, if they were there, were fully trained. So the competition was not obvious or direct.
Did you get any impression, though, when you did, when you qualified and got your wings, did you get any impression that the Cranwell people regarded themselves as a rather superior breed to the short service people?
I don't think the Cranwellians themselves gave that impression at all, but I think the impression was given, and I remember one particular event which upset a very large number of short service officers, and it was done by Lord Trenchard himself. He said he would like to talk to all Royal Air Force officers with a permanent commission, and he did so at Uxbridge. We short service officers felt very left out to think that the head of the Royal Air Force was prepared to talk only to people with a permanent commission. That was no reflection at all on the Cranwellians, but I think was a surprising thing for such a great leader to do.
Do you think that was just an error of judgment on his
It was an error of judgment, but of course Cranwell was one of his tremendous inventions, Halton being the other.
Do you think it was simply that he was so proud of it that he rather gave them pride of place?
But we thought that he thought we were inadequate. I think what you think at the time is what matters. Looking back on it, if he had to talk to every pilot in the Royal Air Force, he would have needed the Albert Hall.
Did he in fact ever come and talk to you, visit you at Duxford?
As far as I know, and this is one of the things one can reflect about this tremendous leader, I've never met anybody of my generation who met him, other than in the war when he went round as a figurehead, long after he'd retired. And incidentally, it's interesting to reflect that he never actually went abroad other than to France in the First War.
Did you feel when you were actually at Duxford that this was rather a shortcoming, that possibly the people in Whitehall, in the Air Ministry rather, didn't know what was going on all the time at the squadron?
At that age, I don't think your horizons are anything like as big as that. My horizon was limited by Duxford and the other two squadrons. We were determined to be better than them, and the horizon was limited by the wing commander, the station commander. There was a group headquarters, but it wasn't a thing we knew about. And Whitehall, we had never heard of.
As you say, there were three squadrons based at Duxford. What was the relationship between these three squadrons as regards both social life and professional life.
Tremendously friendly with tremendous rivalry. The social life was all in one mess, but life is so different now. In our squadron, we had the married officer. All the rest of us lived in the mess, and that applied to all the squadrons. We were all very sorry for the married officer who had to go home at night.
Well, now we come on to social life. What sort of things did you pass your time doing outside working hours at Duxford?
There were certain... Well, I think, first of all, the amount of free time was very limited. There were five dining-in nights a week in mess kit. We were a long way from anywhere, but enough of us had a car to go normally to Cambridge for supper when a steak was half a crown. When we were very rich, we would go to London and stay in the Turkish baths at Jermyn Street because it was the cheapest bed and breakfast you could get. The other side of it was a part of life which has gone. That is, we had to call on certain people in the county, and where there was a duty roster for that, and on Wednesday afternoons or Saturdays you could be detailed to call on Mr. and Mrs. so-and-so. And of course you had to call on your station commander and your squadron commander and their wives.
Was a lot of sport played?
There was sport every Wednesday and, of course, every Saturday. And you were expected to be there. It wasn't a half day. It was a day for sport, unless you were crippled, in which case you probably wouldn't be there. I think it's worth mentioning that there were no engineer officers at all. There was one equipment officer, but the general duties officer really was a general duties officer, and we, between us, did everything, maybe in some inadequate way if it wasn't flying.
What sort of things did you have to turn your hand to yourself?
I was in charge of the forced landing ground and the inventory for it. I also was in charge of one of the sports, I can't remember which, swimming, I think it was. And I was mess secretary later on in my career when I'd become a flying officer.
What was the forced landing ground?
The forced landing ground was a grass field, actually at Sawbridgeworth, near Saffron Walden, where you trained. You had the farmer's permission to land in it when you wanted. And the object was that you would practice cutting your engine and landing in that, or your instructor would cut your engine without you knowing where you were or where the field was, and you were told to land. And if you were quick, you saw which field was the best one to land in. It had a beacon for night work, but we, of course, didn't do any night flying.
What other equipment was there that you had to keep
There were, for some extraordinary reason, there were flares and fire extinguishers and things like that. I remember I got into trouble because they were all stolen. But I didn't get into serious trouble.
What did your duties as mess secretary that you mentioned later on, what did the duties involve there?
It's long before they had people like mess managers, and it was run by a mess committee. The whole mess was that you may have had an outside caterer, and you had to keep the books in some cases, which I couldn't do, but somebody else could do. You had to ensure that the rules and notices were published. Not that they were obeyed. That was up to the senior officers in the mess to see that they were obeyed.
Were there a lot of rules in the mess?
There are a lot of rules that would be rather unpopular these days. For example, you always all got up if an officer senior to you came in the mess. You didn't read a newspaper until he'd sat down. At a dining-in night, you always had to say good evening to the senior officer in the room when you came in. And of course, you could not leave till the senior officers had left. It was a very disciplined life, which was extremely good for you. And the regulations on what you could wear in the mess were extremely strict. For example, it was mess kit 5 nights a week, but on the other nights, supper had to be a suit, and sports clothes with a shirt and tie, of course, at any time.
Did any cliques form within the mess at any time? You mentioned that Cranwell people didn't particularly regard themselves as superior, but were there any groups which did?
The only clique I remember was the bridge playing clique. There was a lot of bridge played, and it was very clear to me very early on the thing to do was not to play bridge, because if you admitted you did play bridge, you were always asked to make up a four, and regarded as a cad if you wouldn't. So the easiest thing to do was not to play bridge. That's the only clique I remember. You had, of course, in the mess, the odd eccentric chap, as you do in any society, who people either didn't like, or he was one of these people who didn't like other people, but they were easily handled.
In general, what was discipline like in the squadron as regards general conduct and flying in particular?
Discipline was incredibly good because we were all there with one object, that was to fly. We would do anything to do that, and the worst thing that could happen to you was to be told you couldn't fly. It wasn't a discipline of fear at all. It was a discipline that you imposed on yourself in order to do what you most wanted to do, including keeping your aeroplane so small.
Was being grounded one of the punishments?
Oh yes, you could be grounded, and that was the worst punishment you could have.
Was this a punishment that was imposed simply for flying misconduct, or for misconduct in
normally only for flying misconduct, which would of course include being late, as well as being stupid.